Coming up this week, the return of Commander Keen.
A new way to play your favourite Sega Mega CD games.
And we get some incredible inside stories from Gremlin and Sega with Chris Shrigley.
Welcome to the Retro Hour Podcast, episode number 178, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And I'm surprised Joe actually managed to make it in today because I don't know if you had money for petrol to for your car after all that money you spent out in Japan.
Yeah, it did cost me a few gold coins out there.
Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa, arigato.
Now, you've been out to Tokyo.
Yeah, so it's Tokyo for 10 days for my 30th birthday.
Yeah.
Celebrated in style. So it was like a dream come true. It was another world.
Well, Ravi and I were watching your Instagram when you were out there and you got a few pickups.
Yeah, I got 27 games, which sounds a lot, but I actually spent less on those 27 games than I usually do at like any sort of retro play expo convention, which was quite nice.
Wow. Is it cheaper out there then?
Retro gaming is, yeah. Massively. Just overall, everything was kind of cheaper other than clothes, kind of noticed, so I didn't really buy any clothes.
Was it all, what's the word, kawaii?
Kawaii.
Yeah, we went to a place called Harajuku, which is like... just mad for that, like everywhere.
Nice.
Just like giant candy floss, bigger than my wife. Like, just like, okay.
I saw you posing pictures of it doing the V sign with your fingers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We also did the photo booths with a friend we met out there who lives out there who we were visiting, and you know, where they make your eyes giant and everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, real.
What's like the big, there's like a big retro gaming market out there, isn't there?
So, there's a whole town called Akabara, which we spent 3 nights at. And it's the Electric City. And I think it's the Electric City, that might be Shinjuku. But Akabara is like the gaming, retro gaming central of the world. And like, you know how usually you'd like walk into John Lewis or something like that, like this big 5-story building. You walk in and it's just games toys. And it's just like 5, 6, 8 floors of it. And just big, you know, just superstores. It's not like a little store like, you know, in a shopping centre somewhere. It's the shopping centre is gaming.
Can you haggle?
No haggling. But it's just unbelievable, you know. And they don't speak a word of English either. So you're just there, like, buying a game, and they're like, no English. And you're just like, oh, no, that's cool, it's cool. Like, just take my money.
That's where your translation apps come in handy.
Yeah,
guess,
absolutely. The wife was everywhere with that.
Yeah.
So.
I had a friend, actually, a guy I know called Alex, is out there the same time as you.
Yeah,
and he was in all the gaming markets. So yeah. I bet you were fighting with him over stuff. So,
I did notice Super Potato, the big one everybody knows.
Yeah.
There was like one other English guy in there when I was in there at one point, and I was like, oh, okay.
Hey, Joe, tell me the only other English people you saw in Tokyo were like at the gaming shops.
It's crazy.
It's worth the trip then.
Yes, absolutely. If you want something different.
Now, speaking of going away, actually, this weekend, I mean, when this episode comes out, you and I will be on a plane on the way to Norway.
Yeah, exciting stuff. We've just got our Norwegian krona, haven't we?
Yeah. Yeah.
Ravi was sat next to me, dishing them all out, and I was like, yo, he's got loads of money. He was like, it's only £200. Yeah. I was like, oh, okay.
Ravi's like Del Boy, isn't he? A big roll in it, wadding notes in his pocket. But we're off to Retro Spillmessen this weekend in Sandefjord. If you are anywhere near that area, definitely worth a trip along this weekend. We're going to be doing a few panels as well, including a few that we're going to be playing out on the show over the next few weeks. So we're going to be doing one with Kevin Bayliss, all about Killer Instinct, Donkey Kong Country, Battletoads, Banjo-Kazooie as well, and DJ Slopes is going to be out there as well from Slopes Game Room. He's coming out too. There's going to be gaming tournaments, loads of systems you can play on and everything. So if you want to get last-minute tickets for that, if you are in Norway, worth a trip along, I'll shove all the links in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, we did mention that we've got a great guest this week, Chris Shrigley. We've covered companies like, you know, Gremlin before on the show. Obviously, we talk about Sega all the time. He's got a really interesting history going from, like, you know, the early days of the 8-bit machines right through to working in America at Sega. And he also did stuff at EA as well. And we get kind of the stories of his kind of transition through all these different companies leading up to the present day, really. So there's some really interesting tales in there as well. Even from, like, you know, those early games, like text adventure kind of games that he worked on, like PubQuest.
Well, you'd think he'd start with PubQuest, which would be on, like, either floppy disk or tape. And then by the end of it, he's doing Sega Mega CD stuff. So they're kind of changing format and the stretch of time that he's done is a really interesting one.
Yeah, and he also worked for Disney, and he did stuff on like the NHL franchise as well. So, I mean, you know, really talented guy. So we're going to be chatting to him. Chris Shrigley is going to be our guest on the Retro Hour podcast, and he'll be on in around 15 minutes from now. Now, before we get into the news this week, it's been a really busy one. Obviously, E3's been going on. Quite a lot of retro stuff coming out of E3 this week, actually, including something that hasn't been going down too well. If you remember Commander Keen. We'll talk about that in a minute. But before we do, let's give a big thank you to our loyal supporters. Now, the Retro Hour podcast comes out every single Friday. We bring you the latest in retro gaming news. We'll bring you a fascinating guest every week as well. But the only reason that we can bring the show out is thanks to your support. Now, we do have a little PayPal donation button that you'll find on our website at theretrohour.com. Click on the support section in there. Any amount that you donate is massively appreciated. Really makes a big difference and all goes back into the running of the show. And for making a donation, you will find your place in the very prestigious Retro Hour Hall of Fame. Like this week, thank you to...
Tom Walker.
Raymond Montalban.
John Taylor.
And Stuart Brand.
Who all made donations into the running of the show. And if you'd like to do the same, you can find the link at theretrohour.com. Tom Walker, not the singer. He's very popular right now.
Funny enough, I actually know a guy called Tom Walker as well. So that's what...
Okay. So it's either Joe's mate or a megastar. Either way. Or maybe not. Maybe just someone else called Tom Walker. Thank you anyway, Tom. Right, this week, some really interesting stories. Let's talk about another mini console. I can hear everyone groaning, oh, come on, what they're bringing out now. We've had the Mega Drive Mini that's coming out in September.
Let me Nintendo stop you right there. I saw this and I went, oh, that's a bit different. So I was quite impressed with this one.
Well, this is, you're right, it is different. This is the TurboGrafx 16 Mini, or if you like the PC Engine Mini.
Yeah, I thought this looked, like I say, it's different. I was just reading it as well. We are getting it in Europe, over in the UK, which is quite nice.
It wasn't a very popular system, was it?
Not here.
Not here.
It was a very American kind of base.
And Japanese as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, really big.
They had the TurboGrafx CD, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
they did, yeah.
Because I remember recently Kanye West... named his album TurboGrafx 16.
Oh, really? Yeah. I did not know that. Yeah.
You put Joe off this now.
No, I'm done with it now.
He's a metalhead. But, I mean, when I first read it, I was like, why Konami bringing this out? I didn't realise, actually, Konami bought the rights to the TurboGrafx and PC Engine back like about 10 years ago. Apparently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they own it, which makes sense.
Jumping on the bandwagon.
Yeah, but I mean, they've owned it for a while, and I think, you know, they've done like a few little bits with it, but this, you know, they're calling this the most surprising announcement of E3, that they're coming out with this mini console. And they've revealed six games that are going to be bundled with the US and European editions. It's going to be like all the other ones, a mini system, HDMI out, comes with a controller and everything too. And the ones they've announced so far are Alien Crush, Dungeon Explorer, I think you pronounce this Yeast or Yes Book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, 1 and 2. Ninja Spirit, New Adventure Island, and R-Type. And I do remember people saying that the best version of R-Type was on the PC Engine.
Well, I've got a Wii U.
Yeah.
And that actually has, on a virtual machine, all of the TurboGrafx games.
Yeah.
And R-Type is awesome on that, I must say. Yeah, but I don't recognise half of them.
Yeah. I was going to say, I don't know a lot about the TurboGrafx. Like, obviously, Bonk. Mm-hmm. Was like their big guy, so the Bonk games are probably going to be on there.
And Splatterhouse as well, I
think. Yeah, Splatterhouse 1, was it Splatterhouse? Yeah, it was Splatterhouse 1, wasn't it, on there. So they'll probably pop up, but looking at that straight away, I've only actually heard of like three of them, you know what I mean?
Like out of the mini consoles though, the style of this looks really like the Turbo Graphics. You know, it looks like a nicely done console.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool.
And for me, I mean, being a platform like you guys, I looked through the games list and I was like, yeah, I recognise maybe two or three of them.
Yeah.
But to me, that's a good thing because it's like, I've never played these games before. And it's a way
new
to explore.
Library to explore, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, you know, doing it via emulation, you don't really know how well it's running or whether it's playing like it should. But having something like this, it's an official product, you'd imagine they're going to do it right.
Have they announced any sort of release dates or costs or anything like that?
Well, they've announced that it's going to have a separate multi-tap, which is kind of old school, having a separate multi-tap, considering the new Hyperkin N64 has the four ports at the front.
That's pretty cool, though. Like, pretty cool. Like,
I think
keeping it original, because the original console had two.
You can have five players simultaneously as well. So.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah, looking through the articles I've read so far, I haven't seen anything about an official release date.
Okay.
I imagine the fact they showed that off at E3 this year means it can't be too far away.
I just find it quite funny that E3's now turned into the show that all the retro stuff comes out at. It's like, what?
And they've got, like, you know, CRT emulation and stuff in here as well. Original 4:3 aspect ratio, which I know please you, Ravi. You hate your stretched screens, don't you? So, I mean, it just makes you wonder what other mini console is going to be coming out next. I want an Atari Jaguar CD Mini.
I would love that.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's probably an appeal for that kind of thing in the retro gaming scene. Stuff like, you know, the systems are hard to get hold of now or people have never played.
I'm just trying to
Dreamcast
think.
Portable.
I'm just really scrambling my brain now. Like, what was that that massive flop console that Alan Sugar did?
Oh, the GX4000,
yeah,
the Amstrad.
Something like that, the GX4000 Amstrad Mini.
You know, like, Sky own the rights, don't they?
Emailer Mini.
Yeah, the Amstrad Emailer. You know, all these, like, you know, blueprints and stuff are probably in the back of some dusty filing cabinet at Sky's HQ or something. So, probably wouldn't cost a lot to license.
What's
it.
That Apple one as well that came out?
The Pippin.
The Pippin.
Yeah. I don't think Apple ever want to see the Pippin again.
The Pippin Mini.
That probably wouldn't happen. But the GX4000, actually, is a system you can pick up pretty cheap. I was in, I didn't buy one because there's not many games for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the library doesn't really interest me all that much. I mean, as a, you know, peculiarity, I'm quite interested in it, I guess. But there's one in, there's a game shop in Lincoln.
Okay.
I was over there like last summer and they had one in there, I think, boxed for about 50 quid.
It's not bad, is it?
Yeah, I looked at it and I was like, I said, the guy, have you got any games with it? He went, oh, there's one, like a racing game.
Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't pick it up. Maybe I will at some point.
A friend of mine, Richard, he had two, funny enough, when he used to collect. I don't know what he sold them for when he sold his whole collection, but yeah, he had two, funny enough, and I thought that was quite funny, but they always just reminded me of that really cheap, like the way they were built and the feel of them. It's like, it felt like a Millennium Falcon, like, you know, like a play set that you get, like, you know, this could just break, like, so
if
easily.
You went like that, yeah.
When all the Americans come over to the game shows here, they're all looking for them.
Yeah.
Because they just can't find them in America at all. So they'll find them at some obscure show in England and be like, right.
And that Commodore 64 game system.
Yeah, GS as well.
I saw one of those at Play Expo, actually. I think he had it from Asobi Tech. And there's not many of them around now, but that was like the Commodore 64 put into, essentially like the GX4000, put into a case. I think actually, they had like the cassette headers and all that hidden away by the plastic. So it was just a Commodore 64 motherboard put into a case without a keyboard. But then, like, you know, the infamous story is one of the games that came with it. It said press F1 to start and it didn't have a keyboard on it.
Yeah.
But I remember my local Tandy selling those off for 19 quid each.
Brilliant.
Last one I saw on eBay went for about 500-600 quid. So, yeah. Should have picked up a few of them in hindsight. So let's talk about the return of Commander Keen, another announcement at E3. Commander Keen, obviously, legendary platformer back in the day on the PC.
Yeah. Commander Keen was kind of the attempt by id Software to kind of do a platformer for the PC, because there was other titles later. Jazz Jackrabbit was a famous one, but Commander Keen was really the first kind of platformer, and the scrolling on it was beautiful. It was a really nice game, actually, and they did quite a few follow-ups, didn't they, later?
Well, you remember back then the PC in like the late 80s, it wasn't really a machine that was built for platform games.
Yeah, people didn't think it could do platform games.
So it was a bit of a technical achievement that they managed to release that on the PC platform of the day. I mean, you think then most people are running like, you know, CGA or EGA with a built-in bleeper speaker.
But also Duke Nukem, you remember the original of that was a side-scrolling platformer.
Well, it turns out all these years later, at E3, one of the things that's been getting most talked about is there is a new Commander Keen game on the way. Now, if you watch the little...
This is not a new Commander Keen. This is a commercial lie. Just to make money. So it looks awful.
I'm not familiar with Commander Keen. Well, that familiar. I know what it is.
Yeah.
I've never played it or anything, but you guys have spoke about it and I've seen it and stuff. And this just looks like a cheap...
Tacky mobile
game that you download for free. Like... It's a knockoff of another popular game. You know, this is when Flappy Bird comes out, this is like Flappy Man. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is, I don't know, the animation on it, everything, it just looks cheap.
Well, it is a phone game, And it's like, you know, Bethesda have put this up on their YouTube channel. At the moment, it's had 127,000 views, 393 thumbs up, 5,700 thumbs down. Which kind of says it all. And it has been, I don't think I've seen one positive comment about this game.
No, it looks awful. That's all I'm going to say. Like, mobile, think of the games that you can do now. Yeah. And this is like an old Java game or something. This is really very bad.
iPhone free.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, the top comment with over 1,000 thumbs up is, look how they massacred my boy. Which just says it all.
Oh, and I bet you'll have play to win as well. I bet you'll be able to, like, just buy a thousand gold coins and then beat everybody up.
I don't know, in the trailer, like, some sort of, like, you've got cards, like, tools at the bottom, and I bet they're going to have to be, like, bought in booster packs or something.
Well, that happened recently as well, because the Lemmings game came out on the mobile phone, and a lot of people said, I like it, and then a lot of people were saying, no, there's too much of this coin buying and this
oh, really?
Kind of thing with the new Lemmings title as well. And some people were saying it was quite decent, actually, which is quite odd.
There's another comment here that actually rings what I was thinking when I first saw this. Who are they aiming it at? Because, you know, you think of, like, players who played the original Commander Keen, that was, like, 30 years ago.
They're going to be 35 to 45 years old.
Yeah, yeah, at least, yeah. And it's like, are they going to want to play, like, what looks like a mobile phone game for seven-year-olds?
It's yeah, it's a bit of an odd one.
Yeah.
Is that it's going to appeal to those people who now have seven-year-olds.
Yeah.
And it's like, look, this is like a remake of what I played, you know what I mean?
But it's not very good. So, you know, if you did play that as a kid, you're going to look at that. I mean, like pretty much all these comments are saying, like, it looks dreadful. Mm. So you're not really appealing to people that played it first time around and remember Commander Keen with, you know, fondness. And kids are not going to care who he is because they don't know who Commander Keen is.
I think this is what happens when retro becomes a trend.
Yeah.
So someone will say, oh, let's do it retro. Great Commander Keen. And then they'll put no effort in at
Maybe
all.
Maybe it's just like, Bethesda were just like, what IP do we own?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Fallout Shelter.
Are we making money from it?
Fallout Shelter was... Yeah, yeah. The Fallout mobile game was popular, so... Let's do a mobile game. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's the only thing I can think of.
I love LGR did a video about it. Did you see him?
No, I haven't seen that yet.
He literally walked up to it. It's a six-second video. He puts his phone up to the screen and goes, nope. And he walked. That's it, the end of the video. Sums it up, I think. But the thing is, recently, you know, when these kind of, you know, we've seen it a lot with, like, you know, the Sonic movie, for example. When it gets this big backlash, often developers and companies are now a bit like, oh, okay, maybe we should refine that or change it. I mean, maybe they'll listen to the feedback and it might...
No, they just need to scrap that and start again. It's like...
A proper new Commander King
absolutely game. Nothing like the original. Yeah. Yeah, crazy.
That could have been any other game, couldn't it?
You could have just put, like, two politicians' faces on it and called it, like... politics war. It would have been fine, you know.
Just trademark that quickly. Hey, some of them might interest you, Joe. I know you're a big Sega fan. You've got your Mega CD collection at home. You've got your 32X. You've got your nice little original system. You're excited about the Mini. What about having essentially an EverDrive that would let you play your Mega CD games without having to use discs?
This looks pretty rad.
Now, this is the Mega SD, the world's first Mega CD optical disc emulation cartridge.
So how does this work? Does this, like, plug in and pretend it's a Mega CD and all that's just done on the one cart?
Literally. Yeah. It goes straight in to the Mega Drive and then it lights up, which looks pretty cool.
Anything with lights on, yeah.
Anything with lights on.
Yeah. Pretty light.
Absolutely. And it looks like a Virtual Racer cartridge, which I thought was kind of cool. And then it just plays Sega CD games.
Well, it plays original Mega Drive games too.
What is this, like, wizardry? Like?
But we talked last week about Sega releasing a piece of plastic for the Mega CD. So if you now cut this piece of plastic open, put the cart inside, you might actually have your Mega CD add-on.
There you go.
It's so rough. You're thinking of hacking it and modding it already. Not even come out of this thing yet. But yeah, I mean, I've got an EverDrive for my Mega Drive.
Yeah.
But looking at this, I mean, it really does what the EverDrive does, but it can also play ISO files.
Okay.
So as well as ROMs, you can put like 600 megabyte CD images on here and it'll stream them to the Mega Drive.
It's quite an expensive item at $232, I think.
Euros.
Yeah, even more.
That I saw it when Dan.
I was going to say dollars. It's all right, but euros. It's on the high end, isn't it?
Yeah,
you expect to get the Mega Drive as well.
I was pretty excited about it, and then Dan showed me. Well, showed me the article, and I was like, oh, it's the last thing on the whole article as well. Yeah. The price of it. But what's quite interesting, as I've just seen, is it plays 32X cartridges.
If you have a 32X.
If you have a 32X.
Yeah, the EverDrive can as well, I believe. So
can it?
It's not really giving you anything more over the EverDrive, which is like half the price, apart from the streaming of CD images.
But it also works with the analog, the new Mega Drive.
Oh, yeah, the SG analog. It's cool and everything. You can do the Master System games as well, like the EverDrive can.
Yeah.
But really, all you're doing is, I mean, you know, for €232. I imagine you can pick up a Mega CD.
Pick up a Mega CD.
And an EverDrive.
Yeah. To be fair, yeah, you could actually. So Mega CD, you can probably get a Mega CD one for about £100, maybe a little bit more.
I saw two actually for about £60 the other day. Yeah, Mega CD two. So that's the thing. I mean, some people don't want to deal with optical discs and all that, which I get it, but I understand this is like a project that's not made by like Konami or someone like that, so it's going to have a bigger overhead cost.
They can't do huge volumes.
I think it's pretty cool if you're downsizing, like you downsized a few years ago, didn't you, Dan?
Yeah.
And you do just like, and you're a big fan of like the Mega CD games, and the Mega CD is really expensive to collect for. If you do want to be playing Snatcher, you know, that is like a £250 game, but then there is another argument. Mega CD doesn't have any sort of lockout on it.
Yeah, yeah. No copy protection.
No copy protection, so you can just copy it. But so
then, also, this would be the like nicest way to play it, wouldn't it? So if you had the HDMI coming out of the analog, you had this in there, it would look really nice.
Yeah, and I think there are people that will want that kind of, you know.
Yeah, if you're that experience. Mega Sega fan.
Yeah, then. So. If you're doing a buy one, if you've got to, you know, spare €232 floating about, Shivalik's going to be out in August in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Let's talk about Dust 2.
Yeah, so Dust is the most famous map in the world of any computer game. You know, they recreated Dust in real life. This is absolutely crazy. An artist rebuilt parts of the level in Germany. So what's happened now is it's officially Counter-Strike's birthday, 20 years.
And God, that makes me feel old.
And it's now turned into Counter-Strike Go, which is a kind of total different version of Counter-Strike to the original.
Yeah.
And we actually had Min Leon, who in episode 61, who created Counter-Strike. So if you listen back then, you can hear all about it.
Gooseman,
yeah. So they're talking about Gooseman and Jess Cliff originally releasing it in 1999. And to celebrate that, they've actually put Dust 2 in Counter-Strike Go. So they've got the original map Dust 2 with the old school textures in there.
I was going to say, it's got the old school graphics, hasn't
it? Yeah, because they've got a Redux version on CSGO. So they've got a new Dust.
Yeah,
but they've bought the old one back just for this anniversary. I think that's pretty cool that all these new CSGO players will be playing a 20-year-old map.
Yeah.
That probably people who are their dads used to play. Yeah.
You know what? That reminds me. I met up with my cousin, my baby cousin, about 2 years ago, who's now 18, so he's not my baby cousin anymore, and he's a big CSGO player.
Yeah.
And he found out that I was a console player, and he, you know, scoffed. The fact that, you know, I'm a console player.
You console lamer.
Yeah, like, kind of thing. And I was just like, right, okay. And then he was like, I bet you don't even know what CSGO is. And I was just like, it's Counter-Strike, boy. And he just looked so shocked that I knew what Counter-Strike was.
Like it's been around since before you were born.
Yeah, exactly.
So when we were kids, we had one period, we had a huge social group of mates, and then suddenly Counter-Strike came out and half the social group split. Like literally half of them was stuck at home playing Counter-Strike, throwing knives at each other. And the other lot were all going out and talking to girls. It was
which side were you on?
I was on the girls talking side.
Oh, okay.
I've never been more disappointed in you. But I mean, actually, these textures do hold up quite well looking at these screenshots, I think.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, a PC that's specced out today can probably run it quite smoothly.
4K, I don't know if they'll look amazing. Maybe not.
But they're saying, obviously, with it being the 20th anniversary, they're not sure how long this is going to be up for. So.
Yeah. So play it whilst you can.
Get it while you can. So, I'll shove that in our show notes as well. Now, just one quick story to cover before we chat to Chris Shrigley, our special guest this week. Speaking of episodes that we've done in the past, do you remember we had Lewis Castle on?
Yeah.
And we're talking about Blade Runner.
Awesome game.
Yeah, amazing game. The thing about it is, Blade Runner has not really been all that simple to play because it's not been on, like, you know, good old games, didn't have it on there. There's not really been an easy way to buy the game. And also, the only way you could really get it is by setting up either DOSBox or a retro PC. And it doesn't run all that well on, like, modern Windows and stuff like that. So a lot of people have been quite interested in playing that game. And now they've actually managed to get it running on ScumVM.
Oh, that's awesome. So ScumVM have been doing lots of little tweaks and stuff. And have you heard of the Residual Engine as well?
No.
So the Residual Engine was another development later on. And that was for Grim Fandango.
Right, okay, yeah.
So you can actually now start running Grim Fandango. And so I was running it on Morphos on weird operating system.
On the Mac,
yeah.
That's cool. Because those later kind of point-and-click adventure games that came out around that time. So that was Westwood game, wasn't it, Blade Runner?
Yeah. And they kind of had support for Full Throttle as well, and they have support for Monkey Island, the one that you liked.
Yeah.
The later animated one.
Well, ScumVM, for, you know, if you haven't used it before, that's how it started, because Scum was the engine that LucasArts used for all their old adventure games.
Creation utility for Maniac Mansion or Manic Mansion, wasn't it?
There you go. Look at that. Look at that knowledge.
I'm sat here just like, wow, where's all this knowledge when we do the Christmas quiz?
True.
But this program was a way that you could play these old games on a modern system, and it just kind of be a wrapper for them. But yeah, they're expanding it to do so much now. And the fact that they're getting into kind of that late 90s era when it was, you know, big CD-ROM games with full motion video and animation. All that's pretty cool.
And I saw recently they were actually tweaking some like edutainment titles and stuff like that that you really don't expect to go on there.
Yeah, well, you know, for this game as well, I think it's cool that now there is an easy way to finally play it, because it's a very atmospheric game, and obviously Blade Runner being one of the biggest, like, you know, sci-fi franchises in history means it's an easy way to play it in your modern system now. So I'll shove that in the show notes as well, along with everything else we've talked about this week. You'll find all the stories at theretrohour.com. A new episode will be out next Friday. We'll have our panel from Retro Spill Messing, our first one. Hopefully on next week's show, nothing will go wrong with the recording, I'm sure.
Well, I'll be off in Brazil as well. Yeah. So I'm going to be talking with the CEO of Sega in Brazil, or Tectoy.
Yeah, so Tectoy are like the official licensee of Sega in Brazil.
Yeah, yeah, but kind of Brazil's the one freaky place where Sega's still rocking it.
They still play Master System.
So we're hopefully going to have an exclusive interview with
Sega. Yeah, it should be good. Yeah, I'm going to try and video it as well. Go to Tectoy and check out that place, and also bring back some toys.
Now, just before we get into our interview this week with Chris Shrigley, if you do like our show, actually, and you like the interviews that we do, there is another great podcast. Very good friends of ours, we recommend that you check out. They've been going for years now as well, the Arcade Attack podcast. And they do really comprehensive interviews. So if you like what we do, definitely worth checking them out as well.
Oh, yeah. Awesome podcast.
So they're at arcadeattack.co.uk/podcast if you want to check them out. Right now, let's get the history of companies like Gremlin Graphics, Sega, and EA with this week's special guest, Chris Shrigley. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for the main event. Then let's welcome on this week's special guest. A pleasure to have you joining us, Chris Shrigley.
Hey, nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, I know you're sitting in the not sitting in the dark at the moment, are you? I know there's a power cut where you are right now.
Well, not quite dark. I mean, it's a beautiful, sunny California day here, but I've got the blinds closed.
It's never dark in California. Well, I mean, we're going to get into, you know, your move up there, because obviously you're from Britain. I mean, how did you originally get into video games and computers when you were a kid then?
Games, I mean, they didn't factor into anything when I first discovered computers, and it was not by design. Purely accidentally. Basically, at school, I was around about 13 years old, and I noticed that there were these kind of weird space-age white boxes that suddenly appeared at the back of one of the classrooms. I was, like, very intrigued. And it turned out they were pets, Commodore pets, and we'd just got them in the school. I just started kind of hanging around. They intrigued me, and, like, all the sixth formers only those guys were allowed to play on them and work on them. So I just kind of sidled in and insinuated myself into everything and kind of slowly got access to them. And then, you know, was able to pick my subjects at school. I chose computer science just so I could get access to them.
Well, when you did get into games, I mean, were you like hanging out at arcades or anything, or playing games on these machines or at friends' houses?
Yeah, I mean, there were games on the PET, like you know, the PET Space Invaders and Lunar Lander and stuff, and those immediately attracted me, obviously. But yeah, most of my game exposure was kind of friends, you know, TV console, like the old Binatone game stuff. And then a little bit later on, when I was a little bit older and I had some money to spend, it was all arcades, you know, just hanging around in arcades and doing the tour of the town centre every Saturday, every chance I could get, really.
For Christmas in 1982, you got a C64. What was it kind of like, that moment when you saw this C64, and how did you persuade your parents to get you one?
Well, I knew about the Commodore 64 from, you know, all the sixth formers they were talking about it, and they had some brochures that they were, like, poring over at school, and you know, this thing looked amazing. It was colour. It had sprites, well, mobs, as they were called, in the brochures. And, you know, so I just sought out every bit of information I could on the thing. I was, you know, magazines, whatever. And eventually I talked my mum into, you know, giving me some money, some of her hard-earned money, combined with an old savings account my granddad set up when I was born, to let me go pre-order one from my local computer shop, which I did. And I remember just waiting months and months for it to be released and arrive in England. And I remember getting, you know, the call from First Byte, which is the shop in Derby that I bought it, that I pre-ordered it from, and that it was in. And, you know, I was down there so quick. It was, it's just an amazing thing to own. I mean, I was only a kid. I was 15 when I got it. And it was mine. It was probably the first thing I ever owned that was mine. And it was it was kind of a revelation, really.
Was that the first time you kind of thought about programming and got into it? And how did you start?
No, I was programming at school. You know, when I got access to the PETs, that's all I did. I was writing little programs, little math programs, and then I haven't carried a notebook around with me always, and I used to, you know, kind of jot down little basic programs and walk around the computer shops in Derby, like First Byte and Datron, and just, you know, write silly little things and run them. So I was programming, nothing really serious because I had limited access to computers. But as soon as I got my my own Commodore 64, that was it. You know, every waking moment that I could, you know, get the thing set up, I was on it and programming.
Peeking and poking,
yeah, yeah. The first thing I programmed actually was a Mother's Day card for my mum, which really impressed her, and I think kind of solidified in her mind that it wasn't a mistake, you know.
Well, I guess, you know, the first time you put something up on the TV, it is like, wow, you know, it's on telly. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, it was like magic. Yeah. My mum didn't know anything about computers, so it was easy to pull the wool over her eyes. You know?
I mean, one game that you was, you know, one of your very early games, PubQuest. And the story behind that game was, after a heavy night of drinking in your local pub, it's time to pay the bill, but you have no money and the landlord wants his cash. So, I mean, it might be a silly question, but what inspired that game?
A love for beer, I guess. Yeah, I mean, we used to, even though I was only 15, you know, there were ways of getting your booze. So it was a keen interest at the time, for sure. Yeah, and that game was actually the first kind of big basic game that I attempted on my 64. And a good friend of mine, Rob Toon, who I worked with quite a lot over the years, he actually wrote a text adventure game. And he was the one that kind of inspired me to write that and encouraged me to write it, but basically told me to write it. You know, I learned a lot doing that game.
How did you end up getting it published then?
Well, it was through my mate Rob again. He'd already got one published with Dream Software, and he mentioned, you know, that I'd written this game about a pub, you know, basically pubs and stuff, and you know, they were interested, sent it off to them, and they liked it, and they published it. It was pretty easy. I mean, it was all accidental. There was nothing planned. So,
but then seeing your game in the shop for the first time, what was that like? Do you remember it?
Oh yeah, that was amazing. I mean, I used to go down to Boots, and they actually had like three or four copies on the shelf, which was just mind blowing. You know, because up until that point, I'd been a consumer. I'd just been, you know, going to these places to play games, and all of a sudden, I had a game on the shelf. I used to go there, and I used to move them all to the front, so, you know, they weren't obscured or hidden.
And were you a fan of text adventure games? I mean, was there any games that influenced, like, PubQuest? Were you playing any, like, text typing games?
Yeah, I was. I think, actually, I'm not sure. I can't remember the timing, whether it was, you know, kind of all jumbled up. But, you know, I loved the Scott Adams adventures, the Hitchhiker's Guide and stuff. But I'm not sure if they came after PubQuest or before, to be honest with you. I think the main reason I wrote it was, again, because of my mate Rob, because he'd written one. And it was kind of the most obvious thing to do, because I could, you know, ask him questions, I could get, you know, help when I got stuck. So I think that was probably more the reason I did a text adventure, because it was kind of the easiest thing. I didn't have to do graphics, for example, you know.
Well, after that, you worked on Bounder, which was, you know, a very ambitious game. What's kind of the story behind that game then, and the process of making it?
Yeah, that, again, was... you know, just kind of an a natural evolution after, you know, working in BASIC and stuff and writing lots of little half demos and half games and never really kind of finishing anything substantial. I, you know, got together with Rob and Andy, a couple of my mates, and we just decided that we were going to write a game. We didn't know what it was going to be, and but we just knew we wanted to kind of collaborate and get together and actually write and work on something together. You know, we set out with that in mind, but Bounder, you know, kind of emerged slowly over the course of a year from that process. You know, we were just hanging around on the park talking about games and ideas. And I mean, Bounder originally started as kind of a Marvel Madness clone.
Yeah.
With a kind of a fancy scroll that I'd done. But yeah, eventually kind of morphed into this tennis ball bouncing game
You ended up sending Bounder to Gremlin. Why did you choose Gremlin? And what was so important about working for Gremlin?
Right, well, yeah, there were only a handful of companies that were interested in. You know, Gremlin and Ocean were the main two. And we managed to kind of get one package together, you know, a disc and, you know, printed some, like a little, you know, little bit of blurb to go with it. And we could only afford to send off and do one packet. We were broke, you know. So we kind of flipped a coin and sent it to Gremlin.
Oh wow!
First, yeah, and they just, we were getting ready to send another copy out to Ocean, but Gremlin, you know, they came back to us really quickly, and yeah, they kind of snapped it up.
History could have been very different then if that coin landed the other way.
Yeah, it could have been. Could have been an Oceanite, and you know, I actually worked with a load of Ocean people a little bit later on, but yeah, and I ended up being a Gremlin.
Well, under Gremlin, Bounder did very well. I mean, I remember that, you know, review in Zap 64, 97% it got, and I know Gary Penn absolutely loved that game in the review. And I mean, it was reviewed very well by magazines, which I imagine was, you know, in that kind of pre-internet age, the magazine reviews could really make or break a game.
Oh yeah, that's all there was. I mean, you know, we pored over the mags, people waited for the mags to come out. And you read them from cover to cover. I mean, every last sentence, you know. So, yeah, I mean, being in a mag and, you know, having a proper game that was proper published by a proper company, it was, you know, kind of a crazy reality, really. And so, yeah, getting that review was kind of a big deal. Gremlin definitely were happy about that.
And in Bounder, I remember the music being really catchy. Did you do the music for the game?
No, I didn't actually.
All right, okay.
I actually implemented it in code, but Andy transcribed it, some kind of, I don't know where he got it from, some piece of sheet music he had at home. And he transcribed it and created all the data. And then I kind of dropped it into the game. The only thing I did compose on that game was the end of level jump bonus music,
right. Which
isn't really music. It's like 10 notes.
Little jingle.
A little jingle. And I put that together in like one evening because we needed something on that screen. So, yeah, that was the only thing I did musically on the game.
Well, you were the key C64 developer there. Why did you prefer the 64 over 8-bits?
I didn't really have much choice. It was kind of clicky at Gremlin. There were two camps. There was the Specky lads and there was the Commodore lads, which was basically me, Andy, Rob. And it's just the way it turned out. I mean, they brought us in as a group, you know, from, you know, when they gave us all jobs after Bounder. And we just became the Commodore guys. And we sat on one side of the room and the Specky guys sat on the other side of the room and we threw paper at each other. And there was a bit of crossover. I did a little bit of Spectrum work, like on Footballer of the Year. But we kind of kept our own camps, really.
It's good to know that playground rivalry existed in the companies as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was friendly. Yeah. I mean, we were, you know, at the end of the day, we all ended up at the pub together. So
no fisticuffs.
No.
Well, I mean, next from Gremlin, I mean, Future Night came along. And looking back at that game, I mean, that was a game that kind of reviewed a little bit mixed. I mean, some people found that game really difficult. And some people say it was a little bit unfair. I mean, was the difficulty setting intentionally set high or what was the story there?
Yeah, well, everything we made was just stupid hard. I mean, Bounder was stupid hard. And that was mainly right down to Rob, who was the designer on the games. And he was just like this monster in the arcades. He could play any game indefinitely. So he kind of tuned everything to his skill levels. And so consequently, everything ended up being really stupid hard. Future Night, we actually started... just before we joined Gremlin, it was, you know, we kind of started that game immediately after Bounder. It took a few months for us to actually end up in Sheffield. So we had a couple of months on the game and they let us finish it basically as our first project there. And it was kind of our homage to Ghosts and Goblins, really. It's very derivative of that.
And that was a hard game anyway, wasn't it?
It was, but, you know, that was a game that Rob and I were both very good at in the arcades, and we kind of wanted to do a version of that, and that was, you know, that was the motivation behind the game. It kind of turned out not so good, you know.
Well, He-Man was huge in the 80s, and you got to work on the Masters of the Universe movie game. What was it like working with a He-Man and such a popular brand at the time?
That was a little bit of a departure, I guess. I mean, we were doing, you know, kind of original games up until then. I think that was probably the first movie license I worked on. And it was just a game that kind of landed on my desk at, you know, Gremlin Derby. And didn't really have much choice. You know, here you go, Chris, this is what you're working on next. We need a game around this movie. And we didn't, I think we got like a preview video and some, you know, like concept art and stuff from the company, but that was it. We didn't really get any other input or guidance from them apart from, you know, some feedback along the way as we made the game. But we had pretty much free rein on that game to do what we wanted. We did go down to London and we got like an actual preview in a private cinema of the movie, which was pretty exciting and awesome again. And but yeah, it was, yeah, it just kind of showed up and we were told to do it.
And a few years later, when, you know, we speak to developers who worked on like movie games maybe in the 80s, they often got like a Bible, you know, of like rules and situations they're allowed to put the characters in and stuff they couldn't do. But I mean, at that stage, were they kind of just a bit naive to it maybe and just let you get on with it, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, maybe I just wasn't aware of that stuff. Maybe, you know, because there were, you know, Terry Lloyd and I can't remember. They were kind of designing it, so they may have dealt with some of that stuff. You know, I was just in my own little world in programming away, so I wasn't really, you know, aware of that if that happened. That map system was just a nightmare, you know, with everything scrolled vertically so you couldn't tell where you were ever. So yeah, it is what it is, I guess.
Did you get much time to make the game, or was it kind of a tight deadline? Did you have to turn it around quick, or?
Well, everything was turned around quick. Back then, I think probably 6 months max on any game, and that was probably around about 5-6 months, I think, start to finish.
So what was Gremlin like working for at this time? It must have been crazy because they were kind of hitting the big time and, you know, lots of success at that time.
Yeah, I mean, we were in Derby, so they opened, yeah, we were commuting up to Sheffield to start with for about a year, and they felt sorry for us and eventually, you know, opened up this office in Derby for us. And so we were fairly unsupervised and, you know, kind of separate from, you know, the Gremlin headquarters. I mean, we did have, you know, Jeremy and Greg, who were kind of, you know, babysitting us and making sure we didn't do anything really stupid. But, you know, we got into plenty of trouble there. I mean, we were rowdy, you know, we'd surf down the corridors on signs, and you know, all of our neighbors just hated us. You know, we drove them to despair, actually. You know, we made so much racket. You know, we were just these young indestructible kids, you know, having a good time, and we had a good time. Oh my god. Yeah,
well, that Derby office obviously became core after that, didn't it?
It did. Yeah, you know, when I guess the industry went through that crunch, and Gremlin had to kind of economize, or, you know, cut costs and stuff, so they decided to close those the Derby offices down. But and we were all laid off and then immediately rehired. In fact, we had a meeting in Ian Stewart's office, and Jeremy was there and Kevin Orban was there, and you know, they said, oh, sorry guys, you know, we've got to lay you all off and we've got to close the office down, but Kevin has something to say to you. And Kevin, you know, stepped up and he just says, I want to give you all jobs. We're opening another office down there. We're going to do something different. So we're all like, okay.
Mix of emotions in that meeting, I bet.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, oh, hey, it was, yeah, up and down. It was, but yeah, I mean, and then, you know, we basically took the Gremlin offices and we extended them and we kicked down the walls, literally, drop kicking them Kung Fu style. And we just gutted the place. And I think there's actually a photo that I shared a little while ago of us standing with the Gremlin sign all torn up. And we destroyed the Gremlin sign, and we in an empty office ready for core to start.
because we're based in Nottingham, actually, and like I took one of my friends over to Derby a while ago, and we were driving down. You know, there's a Lara Croft Way there now, isn't there? And like, me and my friend was like, "What? Why is it called Lara Croft?" I'm like, "It was made over there in that building." Like, what?
Yeah, that building is not the actual building. I think the original one got knocked down.
Right.
There is a similar one that everybody says that's the Lara Croft Mansion.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when Gremlin Derby core design, that we started off in like Heritage Gate, which is about like a tower block. Well, I wouldn't call it, probably about six stories. And that was closer to the city centre. And then when I'd been gone a couple of years before they actually moved to that big house. But I used to go there occasionally and hang out and see Rob and Andy.
Lock the butler in the fridge.
Yeah, right.
Well, you worked on Footballer of the Year as well, and is it true that that started out life as a board game?
Yeah, it did. It was some fella sent it in. It was all like a big stack of paper and a mock-up board, and the guys played it a little bit, and it played really well on paper. And Ian Stewart just wanted to make something out of it, and so it was handed off to me and Terry. And we sat down and tried to turn it into a computer game.
And did you end up doing the majority of the work on that game then, yourself?
Yeah, I did. I did the whole thing on the Commodore 64. That was actually my first solo project. Up until then, I'd always been working with Andy. And that was my first game by myself. It was quite a trial. A lot of learning on that game. It did pretty well. And so they did the ports to Spectrum and MSX, and I was involved, and the Atari 400, I was involved with those as well.
And I guess with a game like football that's got, you know, traditional rules and everything, it's like you've got to get it accurate as well. You can't just go around, like, you know, changing stuff and changing the rules up as well.
Yeah, well, there wasn't that much actual football playing in the game. It was mostly managing, you know, your teams and, you know, making decisions and rolling dice and stuff like that. So I think the sum total of all the football gameplay in the game was those penalty shootouts. And that was about it. So, you know, rule wise, we didn't have to worry too much about actual football rules.
Well, one game after that that came along that obviously did implement like real life rules was Advanced Pinball Simulator. And obviously pinball is, you know, it's got a lot of physics and stuff as well. I mean, was trying to do a realistic feeling pinball machine a bit of a challenge?
It was. In fact, it was so much of a challenge that I couldn't do it at the time. And that whole game is one big, basically faked out thing. It's the basic ball movement is physics, I guess. But like a lot of the collision detection and the way the ball interacts with the stuff on the board was kind of canned. It would, you know, the ball would hit something and then the code would take over and move the ball around and things like that. So a lot of smoke and mirrors in that game, but it actually turned out, you know, reasonably good. Very close to the specy version, anyway. So, yeah, smoke and mirrors.
Well, how busy were you around this time? I mean, it sounds like you're churning out games every few months. I mean, was it quite an intense time?
Oh, yeah, nonstop. And pinball, the Vince pinball game was actually a side project that Terry and I did, you know, to earn a bit of extra pocket money. So, yeah, that was on top of the games we were doing for Gremlin at the time as well. So yeah, busy, but you know, young, boundless count, you know, energy, not really a problem.
Well, how did you make the move from Gremlin in Derby to kind of working in America?
Oh god. Well, Gremlin became Core, and then Core, well, there's a big story behind that, you know, how I left Core. I've talked about this in other interviews about the trouble with the shares in the company that we were promised. And I was a bit of a rabble rouser and troublemaker. And, you know, I stirred things up a little bit too much, probably, you know, about the fact we weren't getting our fair share. So I was actually fired from Core. But coincidentally, I'd been working for a couple of months with my friend Matt Sneap on starting Eurocomp, because I kind of knew that the writing was on the wall for me at Core. I wasn't particularly happy that we were being, in my view, we were being kind of taken advantage of. So the timing was actually perfect. I got fired and I was planning on quitting. So I quit at the same time, and we had a little bit of a back and forth, who fired who and who quit, which was kind of funny.
I quit.
Exactly. That's kind of how it went down. There was a lot of shouting as well. You know, me and Jeremy in the back office, kind of having a shouting match with each other. But yeah, I was gone. I'd already kind of checked out. Eurocon was already, you know, a thing by the time that happened. So, you know, I left, and then a week later I was up in Ripley, you know, tearing the NES apart and reverse engineering the game system and working with some of their electrical engineers to kind of build our own dev system. We didn't have access to the official dev system, so we were making our own. Real old school stuff. So yeah, I ended up at Eurocom and did a bunch of stuff there, which was amazing, fantastic, great. Again, working with your friends, but they went for a cash crunch. They ran out of money, so I just had a baby. I'd bought a house. I needed money. I needed an income. So I started looking elsewhere. My friend Andy had already left Core by that point, and he'd moved to America working for CinemaWare. So, you know, I chat to him every couple of weeks on the phone, and he was just like pecking away at me. I should talk to Bob Jacob, talk to his boss. You know, they're looking for people, you know. So I did. I went down to London, had an interview, got offered a job. And yeah, in January 91, I think it was, I moved my family to California. Wife, a 1-year-old, and 2 suitcases, and that was the start of a whole new life and adventure.
Bit of a change from rainy Derby.
Oh, massive change, yeah. Yeah, the smells, the sounds, the light, everything. It was an absolute trip.
How did the games industry differ there compared to back home?
Well, I was never really much into the, you know, the workings, you know, the business side of stuff at that point, so to me, it was the same. It was just, you know, here's a manual, here's a piece of hardware, and here's a game we want making, you know, like, figure it out. And so that was all the same. So, yeah, that was the first thing I had to tackle when I got there. And I got a manual that was all in Japanese, and that I had to wade through again and try and figure out the hardware. But, yeah, it's same old, really, just different hardware, different language. I wasn't really, you know, privy to all the businessy stuff.
I mean, did you find working on, like, you know, the 16-bit consoles was different to doing games for home computers? I imagine there's kind of different rules, I guess.
Different rules, but again, just really all the same stuff. I mean, you know, a Commodore 64 has set memory. It has things you can and can't do with it. Same with Sega Genesis. It's just different. I mean, the Genesis was more powerful, absolutely. I mean, you could do more sprites, you know, more colors, you know, more everything. So there was a lot of freedom in that, you know, for us to express ourselves a little bit more.
You made the move onto CD with the Mega CD and Batman Returns. How did you find that?
Yeah, that was an interesting project. We got the Sega CD in because we had a relationship with Sega, and they wanted developers to make stuff for the new hardware. So we kind of got advanced versions of it that we played with. And none of us were really very impressed with it at Acme at the time, because it was very clunky. It was very much a kind of a bolt-on thing, you know. It was they'd basically taken a Genesis and added a CD drive and, you know, some other kind of chips to kind of bind it all together. And the only really exciting thing about it was that it could do, you know, kind of some 3D stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it had built-in scaling and, you know, for bitmaps and things like that. So that was interesting. That was exciting, but it was really just a Genesis. And I actually didn't get to, unfortunately, I didn't get to work on any of the cool stuff. You know, I didn't get to do any of the pretty graphic stuff. That was all John O'Brien, who, absolute genius. And I ended up doing all the unpleasant stuff, like gluing the game together and doing all the CD-ROM subsystems and disc layouts and like the shell and the you know, all the title page stuff, things like that. So anything anyone else didn't want to do, I ended up doing on that game. So basically,
because it was like a standard Genesis version as well that was very different. It was like a more of a like side scroller, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. There was a platform game that was done by Andy Green.
Yeah,
and that was, I had to glue them both together so that they'd, you know, it would go back and forth between the games and maintain state and all that stuff. And it wasn't a trivial job, but it was super, you know, unpleasant and tedious, really. Especially when Andy and John were getting to do all the you know, fun stuff.
You made an interesting point as well about, you know, the first time kind of CD-ROM became available. And I remember walking into a shop and seeing the Mega CD, and yeah, it had like, you know, some kind of primitive video showed on like a postage stamp size window in the middle of the screen and 16 yeah. colours or something. And again, it was like, you looked at it and you thought, oh, it's kind of interesting. But then you saw the price tag. And at the time, I imagine a lot of developers were just trying to find ways to kind of fill this new storage medium. Yet again, you're still in that kind of limitations of the technology of the time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were filling that disc, and yeah, that was actually caused a problem, and that's kind of began shifting games more towards these big productions and bigger teams, you know, because you needed more people to make more stuff.
So you worked for Disney Games too as well. What were like the difference and rules around working with Disney with their IPs and values? Were they very strict?
They were, actually. Yeah, Disney was an interesting experience for me. That was my first taste at, you know, corporate America. And yeah, they had a lot of rules, a lot of things you couldn't do. Although the kind of group I was in at the start, it was pretty small. It was Disney Software. And they'd just kind of, I think they'd only been going for about a year before I was hired. And so they were able to do, you know, they were a little bit more nimble than the rest of the company. So, you know, we were able to do some interesting things. The first game I did there was Gargoyles on the Sega Genesis. And that was very, very controlled on the art side. You know, the original animation company that did the TV show were heavily involved with the animation for the character and, you know, the styles and all that kind of stuff for the game, which didn't really concern me. I mean, on the coding side, you know, I kind of just did my own thing as usual.
Yeah, I guess, you know, being at a company like Disney, you know, being an animation studio, that look has got to live up to their kind of, keep their reputation high, I guess, as well, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they, like I say, they were really super picky about Goliath, you know, the main character in that. And, you know, they actually did all the animation for us. The TV animation people did all the animations that were, and they were all overdrawn by our artists.
And how long were you originally at Disney, folks? I know you went, then you came back again, didn't you, after?
I did. I kind of joined them, I think, 93 or thereabouts. I was there for maybe 2 or 3 years, maybe 3 years. And then I ended up back there again in 2008. There's actually a kind of an interesting story around Eurocom and Disney at this time, because Eurocom, yeah, I'd left Eurocom, obviously, to come to America. And I'd done stuff for Acme and Malibu and ended up at Disney. And Disney were looking for basically companies to do work for them, you know, contracts. And I suggested Eurocom because I was still, you know, talking to Matt and stuff. And so we ended up going over to England, and it was the most surreal thing because I was basically leading a meeting for Disney at Eurocom's offices, at a big conference table with Matt and Hugh and, you know, Tim, all sitting around a table on one side, and me and the Disney, you know, guys on the other side, trying to put a deal together, you know, to give them work. And yeah, it all worked out basically. And it's kind of a strange, you know, full circle thing that ended up kind of getting them a whole bunch of work through Disney.
That must have been a surreal meeting.
It was. It was very surreal. It was very strange, you know, to be back there in a different capacity and kind of, yeah, it was interesting.
Well, why did you leave Disney first time around?
First time around was they, you know, Disney liked to lay loads of people off regularly, and, you know, they throw tons of money into something and then they realize that they're not making the money back that they expected. So they just close everything down and, do something different. And that's kind of the way it is at Disney. So, you know, I joined Disney the first time at the beginning of this big epic cycle where they basically blew $200 million on, you know, putting together Disney software and Disney Interactive. And that arc kind of lasted for maybe 3 years, and then they laid us all off. And well, they actually gave me a choice to move into management or, you know, let be laid off. And I chose being laid off because I didn't want to do management stuff. I wanted to make games.
Well, after Disney, I mean, you went to work at Electronic Arts on the NHL franchise. How did you end up working for EA, and what was it like working for them at that time?
That was a contract, freelance gig after Disney. I did one of the producers I worked with at Disney had some connections, and he picked up the project, and he needed a programmer. And, you know, I just basically left Disney, and I was kind of mulling about what I was going to do, where I was going to go. And he hit me up to see if I was interested in doing, you know, the new version for that year of NHL on the Sega Genesis. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. It sounds like, you know, a lot of fun, and the money was good.
And that must have been quite late in the Genesis's life, was it, doing that NHL game?
Yeah, it was. It was the last game I did. Actually, was it the last game? I think I did a little bit of work on Spider-Man on the Sega Genesis after that. That was for Western Technologies. But yeah, I mean, this was at the tail end. Certainly, you know, my career on Genesis was pretty much over at that point.
You ended up working with Mass Media doing ports for the Game Boy Advance. What was it like working for that system? Was it kind of like going back into the past a bit?
Yeah, that was just one of many projects I did at Mass Media. And that was kind of a quick... I mean, so the guy that ran Mass Media, David Todd, he was trying to build a relationship with Blizzard at the time, and we'd done StarCraft on the N64, and he wanted to do more stuff with them because, you know, prestigious big company, and they were looking for, you know, someone to port these three games: Blackthorn, Rock and Roll Racing, and The Lost Vikings. And so we picked the gig up, and it landed on basically Andy Green and Mai's desk because we were working together again at that point. And it was a bit of a step back in that because we were doing PS2 stuff and Xbox stuff at that point. So going back and trying to, tear apart the graphic formats and writing all the tool set to convert all the assets, and we had to actually pull the assets out of the ROM images and stuff. We had very little source materials for those games. So that was, it was an interesting, fun, difficult project. And we did some really cool and interesting solutions to some of the problems on that game. But yeah, it was interesting going back and, you know, trying to understand an old system like that again.
Well, I was reading an interview that you did in Retro Gamer magazine, I think it was a few months ago, and you're talking about your time at Mass Media. And I know you were there like about 10 years. It was a long time you were there, but you're talking about how you found it quite a difficult place to work. Was that more in the end, and what kind of happened to finally cause you to leave the company?
Yeah, that was a fairly traumatic time, actually. The ending of my time at Mass Media was underlined by me getting sick, basically. I've been working on a game called Tetris Evolution on the Xbox 360. And it was just probably the most brutal project that I've ever worked on, technically and just, time-wise, schedule-wise. And I was doing all the networking because it was a multiplayer Tetris game. I was doing all the networking stuff and it was just a brutal six-month crunch at the end. I was working just insane hours for a prolonged period of time. It basically broke me. And I got sick at the end of the project, and it made me realize that there was kind of more to life than killing yourself. And I got out. Yeah, I needed a change, so I moved on, and that's when I joined Disney for the second time and trying something different, doing MMOs and things like that.
I mean, did you find on the consoles as well? Because I imagine, you know, that the bigger these systems got and the more storage space and the more advanced hardware, and what kind of were you expected to do a lot more, and like with the team sizes not getting bigger to cope with the demands of the hardware and the projects?
Well, I mean, you got to understand what mass media was. Mass media, we did make a few original games at mass media, but we were a chop shop. We were like a hardcore problem solving tech, studio, and we did everyone's, kind of redheaded stepchild projects. Anything that anyone else couldn't do, we ended up doing. Hmm. Everyone there was just a gnarly old low level engineer, and the teams were still small because we were porting most of the time. Typical port, like for example, like Full Spectrum Warrior, for say, there were only like probably five of us on that game. And, we did everything with just a very small team.
Epic game that was, by the way.
I was
addicted to Full Spectrum Warrior, yeah. Because it was just when the Iraq War was going on, so.
Right, yeah. That was a good project. I say fun projects. I mean, mainly challenging, because none of them were really fun. I mean, they weren't very creative things to do, but they were extremely challenging technically to do.
Well, recently people will know you for the RPG game Immortal Darkness: Curse of the Pale King. Could you tell us more about what you're up to these days?
That's basically been my labor of love for the past 2.5 years, Immortal Darkness. And we published it late last year on Steam after, a long time in development. And the project was essentially a vanity project. My friend Damon and I were pretty much into D&D and tabletop gaming, and we always wanted to make a dungeon crawler. It was kind of based around D&D and with all those kind of cool things like treasure and traps and stuff. So we just sat down and decided to make this game, and it turned into a proper full-blown project. We had like 8 people on it. We started a company to do it. And, the game turned out pretty good. Absolutely the game we wanted to make. And what I do now is I maintain that, and I do bug fixes and do all the community stuff and the support for that game while, juggling a bunch of other small projects and prototypes that I'm working on.
That must be very rewarding, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It doesn't get better, really. I mean, it was kind of a dream come true. I mean, I actually left Disney. I kind of retired. I'm doing air quotes, by the way, retired, when I was 45. It was about 7 years ago now. And, I got to do what I wanted to do. And I was unhappy sitting in a cubicle and, doing other people's bidding. So getting the chance to actually, quit and do my own thing and go indie was just a huge dream of mine for a long time. So, yeah, getting to do it, I was very lucky to do that. And luckily I was in a financial situation where I could actually afford to do that.
And it's great that the indie game scene today is so big as well. I mean, you wouldn't have thought that you could have, small teams, and even bedroom programmers are making games that are doing well these days again, which 20 years ago you couldn't have imagined.
Yeah. I mean, indie stuff is it's definitely an exciting, kind of fun thing. It is tough though. I mean, there are so many games out there. It's very difficult to get noticed. It's very difficult to get exposure unless you've got you get lucky, or you've got money, or you've got an in some with some influencer or something. So it's not all rainbows and unicorns. It's actually a very tough business to make money in. But if you can afford to do it, and you can afford to take the risks, it's what it's all about, in my opinion. I mean, it doesn't get better than making your own stuff on your own time.
And looking at the reviews of, Immortal Darkness as well, I mean, it's got some, real hardcore fans. People do seem to love it. So, and the RPG crowd, I imagine, are often quite hard to win over, aren't they? Because they're very serious gamers.
They are. And the game's kind of a little bit weird. It straddles. It's not quite one thing or the other. It's a little unique in that respect. So when people love it, they really love it. We haven't really had anyone hate it. But a few people have scratched their heads over it, trying to figure out what it's about. And then, you know, they play it and they get into it and they get into the story and, you know, they get to play with all the really cool spells and stuff. And, yeah, they end up being a fan. Yeah, we just need to get more people looking at it and playing it, that's all.
Well, I'll make sure we put a link to the place and get it off Steam on our show notes this week as well, Chris. So,
awesome.
Yeah, hopefully everyone will go check it out. It's been amazing getting your stories. I mean, you know, some incredible companies and games that you've worked on over, you know, the past few decades. And long may it continue, Chris. It's been wonderful having you on the podcast this week.
Yeah, thanks. It's been a hell of a ride, and I appreciate the call and the time I can talk to you about it. It's good stuff.